Before we begin, don't forget that if you want to hear this episode ad-free, then sign up to our members channel. Just search for What's the Story Crime in Apple Podcasts or follow the link in our show notes. Members will get exclusive access to all episodes of Smoking Gun, completely ad-free, before anyone else.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the Middle Eastern nation of Kuwait, there is something so large that it can be seen from space. It's a hole dug into the desert and filled each year with tens of thousands of car tyres. Known as the Car Tyre Graveyard, it's not quite what designers were expecting when they first created a rubber wheel which could easily be fitted to any vehicle. Those tyres can clock up to 20,000 miles on average, put through their paces on country roads, high-speed motorways, even racetracks before their life comes to an end. There are tyres designed for elite performance, maximum endurance, extreme weather, and tyres to fit cars, trucks, even tractors. What all of these car tyres have in common is that they've served a purpose and have been discarded after their use has run out. But not all tyres are solely used to move vehicles. Very occasionally, a humble car tyre can be the clue for detectives who are trying to solve a murder.
My name is Sarah Henderson. I've always been fascinated by the world of forensic science, the amazing ways in which crimes can be solved and the clues which can be found almost anywhere.
And my name is Tracy Alexander from Forensic Response UK. I've spent years inside these processes, searching for those clues. I've dedicated my career to using science to help the course of justice. And my work has ensured that hundreds of criminals have gone to prison and the wrongly accused go free.
Together, we're going to lift the lid on some of the most extraordinary cases from around the world.
We'll discover how, with the help of science, everyday items have become the key to catching a killer.
From What's the Story Sounds, this is Smoking Gun. The Car Tyre.
The suburb of Orleans lies 16 kilometres east from downtown Ottawa, Canada. Its 125,000-strong population is mixed, with around a third of inhabitants speaking primarily French at home. A large percentage regularly make the 20-minute commute into the city for work. But despite its proximity to the densely populated Ottawa, its smaller neighbourhoods retain a sense of community. So, in 2008, when a number of houses were invaded, with women's underwear being stolen, it caused somewhat of a panic. In one incident, 186 items of clothing were seized by the unknown intruder. And then, in July 2009, the break-ins started occurring in another, more remote location. 2.5 hours west, down Highway 7, sits the municipality of Tweed, still in Ontario. The population there is just a fraction of Orleans, with around 6,000 inhabitants. So when similar, peculiar, frightening and carefully executed home invasions hit Tweed in late 2009, the anxiety was felt with much more intensity than it had been in Orleans. Then, they took an even more sinister turn. On the 17th of September,
a young mother was sleeping with her 8-week-old baby. As the clock struck 1 a.m, she heard a noise. Bleary-eyed, her heart started pounding. Before she could make sense of what was happening, she was confronted with a male intruder. By the time he left, 2 hours later, he had sexually assaulted and taken photographs of the mother, all without revealing any identifying clues. In the same vicinity, just over a week later, another spate of break-ins occurred at a different house. For 2 nights in a row, someone entered the home of Laurie Massicotte and stole items of clothing. Both times, Laurie was out at the time. On the third evening, however, she was home alone in that same property when the intruder returned. When she confronted him, he blindfolded her, tied her wrists, choked, and sexually assaulted her. The ordeal lasted for hours. Nobody in Tweed was in doubt. The break-ins, the strange occurrences, the sexual assaults, they were all down to one man. And many locals started to suspect they knew his identity.
Larry Jones returned to his home on Cozy Cove Lane after a weekend of partridge hunting in late October 2009. As his car drove down the dusty Tweed Road and neared the modest home he shared with his wife Bonnie, he noticed a hive of activity at his front door. For Cozy Cove Lane, in fact for Tweed in general, this was no normal thing. Then he noticed cars, specifically police patrol cars. The sight worried him. Police at your front door can never be a good thing, he thought to himself. But the dozens of officers weren't just at his front door. They were inside, scouring his property too. Before Larry even had the chance to formulate a question in his mind, he found himself handcuffed and racing to the police station. His wife, Bonnie, was brought in too. As Larry settled in one of the bare-walled interrogation rooms, the OPP officer, sitting opposite, made clear what the allegations were. He was the police's prime suspect in the string of break-ins and, more recently, sexual assaults that had plagued Tweed. It transpired that despite being blindfolded, Laurie Massicotte thought she recognised the voice of her attacker. She thought the voice belonged to her neighbour, Larry Jones. The interrogation with him would last for hours, with his wife Bonnie too. The police probed, asking personal questions as to Larry's sexual proclivities. His DNA was swabbed, fingerprints taken, and he even took a lie detector test. It took weeks before the police finally ruled him out as a suspect. By then, the damage was done to Larry's reputation locally, and worse was to come.
Corporal Marie-France Comeau wasn't your usual member of the armed forces. She was, by all accounts, a bohemian, artistic lover of life. She lived to explore, to learn, to taste. And that's what drove her to join the military. Quickly, Marie-France rose as a respected corporal and military flight attendant, ferrying high-profile passengers on state trips, including the then Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper. Just 3 days after that flight, however, her burgeoning dreams would come crashing down. Marie-France came back from her most recent trip with a spring in her step. But when she finally made it home to Brighton, in Ontario, to rest before her next assignment, she noticed someone had been through her underwear drawer. It disturbed the weary corporal, but she put it down to her ex-boyfriend's possessive behaviour and moved on. One evening, she picked up her phone and called a friend. They spoke for around 40 minutes. Marie-France perched on the end of her double bed. Feeling it was time to retire for the night, she said goodbye down the line and hung up. Before brushing her teeth, she trudged downstairs to look for one of her cats, to make sure it was inside before locking up. The search continued down into the basement, where finally she spotted the cat. But it wasn't alone. Her cat was there, but it was staring at a man with his face covered. In return, he was staring right back at Marie-France. In the blink of an eye, he launched a brutal assault with his flashlight. Marie-France was caught totally unaware, but she fought the intruder bravely. Eventually, the masked man was able to subdue her, knocking the corporal unconscious. Still in the basement, the intruder tied her hands tightly with her own clothes to a wooden post. There, he snapped photographs of her naked body before moving her to the bedroom, where he raped her repeatedly for the next 2 hours. The entire horror was captured on film. Exhausted and still fighting back, Marie-France called out to her attacker, "I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't deserve to die." But her cries fell on deaf ears. The man placed duct tape over her eyes, mouth, and nose. At 3:30 a.m., Marie-France suffocated to death.
Marie-France Comeau was supposed to have the day off on November the 25th, 2009. Nobody expected to see her in work, so her absence didn't immediately raise alarms at CFB Trenton, the Air Force base where the corporal was based. But after 24 hours without hearing from her, Marie-France's boyfriend made his way to her house. She'd given him a key at an earlier date, and moments after he turned it in her front door and let himself in, his heart started pounding. There, in front of him, was his girlfriend's dead body. He was violently shaking as he dialed 911. The next words that came out of his mouth were barely believable. He told the operator down the line that he had found his girlfriend and that she had been murdered. The Ontario Provincial Police were fast on the scene. The forensic specialists soon followed, adorning white coveralls. They searched the house top to bottom, swabbing for DNA, dusting for fingerprints, and looking for any signs of forced entry. The search was ultimately in vain. And the lack of any evidence of forced entry meant investigators initially described the death as a suspected suicide. Then, when it was reclassified as murder, their attention turned to Marie-France's boyfriend. Under intense scrutiny and through a lie detector test, he remained firm in protesting his innocence. When no evidence was found supporting the police's theory that he was involved, and after the lie detector test results came back, Marie-France's boyfriend was released without charge. The murder sent shockwaves through the army base. Her colleagues were horrified. And further afield, some speculated that her murder may be linked to the spate of strange break-ins down the road in Tweed. But the connection was quickly dismissed by those investigating, and all leads soon went cold.
People who knew Jessica Lloyd would always describe her as the model friend. A kind of friend everyone should strive to be. Often, Jessica was described as witty, and her wide smile would reliably light up any room she entered. On the evening of Thursday, the 28th of January, the 27-year-old Jessica was settling down for the evening after a day spent watching TV with friends. To let them know she'd arrived home safely, she typed a simple text message into her cell phone. "Night, night," it read. The digital clock on Jessica's bedside table showed the time as 10:30 p.m. Her alarm was set for early in the morning the following day. She was due at work. The Hastings and Prince Edward District School Board at 8 a.m. on Friday morning. Almost as soon as her head hit the pillow, Jessica was soundly asleep. The next day, however, her colleagues noticed she was running late. Initially, it didn't ring any alarm bells, but as the minute hand continued to tick, then the hour hand, colleagues started to suspect something wasn't right. Andy Lloyd's phone was in his pocket when he started to feel it vibrate. He lifted it out of his pocket and saw it was his mother calling. He pressed the answer button and raised it to speak. She sounded tense. His sister Jessica had never made it to work. Andy was equally worried. It was totally unlike her to not tell colleagues or even family members if she was unwell. So he jumped in his car and drove the rural stretch of the road to her house to check in on her. As he peered inside, calling Jessica's name to warn her of his presence, he noticed her purse on the counter. Her keys were still inside, money, identification, even her cell phone. But no response from Jessica. As his search continued, he realized, in fact, that she had vanished out of thin air.
Police were swift to initiate a missing persons report and start the search. It was assisted by the family, with her brother Andy organising a party of locals to plaster the streets with missing posters. In the air above, a police helicopter hovered, searching the surrounding area for any clues, any evidence that might uncover where Jessica had disappeared to. But they did not link her disappearance to Corporal Marie-France Comeau's murder, nor to the series of sexually motivated break-ins in the nearby Tweed. To OPP detectives, Jessica's case was simply another missing persons investigation. On the night she'd gone missing, two local truckers had driven past Jessica's house on Highway 37. The night was cold, typical for January in Ontario, and the surrounding area was lit up by a full moon. Lyle Barker was sat in the passenger seat of their white pickup. It was 3 a.m. and his eyes were struggling to stay open. But he remained alert. As an avid wildlife observer, he was always on the lookout for what the Canadian countryside had to offer. As they passed Jessica's house, however, it wasn't wolves or bears that caught the attention of Lyle. Instead, he noticed an SUV parked in an obscure location. It wasn't near the road, nor near anybody's home. It was a sight that would stick in his memory. Returning in the opposite direction after he and his cousin had finished their trucking job, Lyle Barker saw the posters adorning the lampposts and bus stops with Jessica's face on. Then the presence of police next to the house by which they'd spotted the misplaced SUV jogged their memory. Lyle felt compelled to inform the police of what he'd seen. The tip came at just the right time for the team of officers investigating Jessica Lloyd's disappearance. The weather had remained cold, but without snow or rain falling. So when they pulled up to the spot where Lyle had seen the vehicle, there, in mud, was a perfectly preserved set of tyre marks. Not only were they perfectly preserved, the pattern set in the dirt was uncommon in nature.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thursday, February the 4th, 2010. Colonel Russell Williams was driving his SUV down Highway 37. The road connects Tweed with the lakeside city of Belleville. The drive was one he'd done countless times. You see, Colonel Russell Williams was a high-ranking officer and decorated pilot with the Canadian Air Force. In 2010, he commanded CFB Trenton, Canada's largest military airbase. During the week, Colonel Williams would stay in a cottage in the remote Tweed and take Highway 37 most days to the military base. His wife lived a couple of hours east in the home they shared together in the Ottawan suburb of Orleans. Friends and fellow students from the University of Toronto said Williams was spurred on to join the military by a love of the film Top Gun. In it, hotshot fighter pilot Maverick, played by Tom Cruise, is in training to become a pilot at the Top Gun Naval Fighter Weapons School. His reckless attitude and self-assured demeanor put him at odds with the other pilots. And much like Maverick, the young Colonel Williams displayed signs of a mischievous side. He would often play pranks on fellow students, some of which would involve hiding in their closet for hours on end awaiting their arrival. When they entered their bedrooms, he would jump out, giving them a fright. Russell Williams' dream of becoming a pilot became a reality in his early 20s. He rose the ranks, becoming one of the country's most respected pilots, flying in to support war efforts or natural disaster recovery missions. As his hair started to grey, Colonel Williams' responsibilities at work increased. He was often seen on TV engaging in public appearances. In 2005, he commanded the late Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip's flight to Canada. Prime ministers and other dignitaries were often transported under his supervision. Then in 2008, he took command of CFB Trenton, a huge job for the ambitious colonel that would make him recognisable to many nationwide. His car pulled along Highway 37 at a leisurely pace. In keeping with his military background, Colonel Williams never ran late. He was rarely in a hurry. But that day, Thursday, February the 4th, 2010, he would be late to work. Ahead, he spotted a roadblock. The Ontario Provincial Police were stopping any SUV that passed by in the hunt for the still-missing Jessica Lloyd. Colonel Williams obeyed the officer's signal for him to pull over. He addressed the gathering group of officers with respect. As one officer leant into his car, chatting casually, another checked the colonel's tyres. Then, as if nothing had happened, they said he was free to leave.
Unbeknownst to the colonel, police had recognised the tyre tread on Williams' Nissan Pathfinder. It had resembled the unusual markings found in the field next to Jessica Lloyd's house. From that moment, he was closely watched. Every move he made, he was followed by officers from the Ontario Provincial Police. The Sunday after he'd been pulled over on his way to work, he received a phone call. At the time, he was settling into a new house in Ottawa. The voice at the other end of the line asked him to come into the nearby Ottawa Police Department for questioning. Williams thought nothing of it. By this time, the investigators working on the spate of crimes in Tweed had thrown their net wide. As a part-time resident of Tweed, he thought it likely he would be called in at some point. The interrogation room at Ottawa PD had two green chairs in it, a white desk and white windowless walls. Colonel Williams entered the room smiling and cracking jokes with the interviewing officer, Detective Sergeant Jim Smith. He emitted an air of self-confidence. Sat with one leg shaking slightly, he explained to Detective Smith how the closest thing that he'd previously experienced to the ongoing questioning was when he was granted his top secret security clearance in the Canadian military. But not long after the detective clicked record on the interview tape, Colonel Williams was made patently aware of why he'd been called in that day. It wasn't for the reason he thought. The detective explained that his tyre marks, and indeed footprints, matched those found on or near the property of missing Jessica Lloyd. As the interview continued, Williams became visibly more anxious. His jaw clenched tight.
his shaking left knee increased in speed. Detective Smith employed what was called the Reed technique. It uses non-accusatory questions at the start and focuses instead on questions that will provoke behavioural responses. If that behaviour leads the interviewer to suspect guilt, then 9 steps are followed. 1. Direct confrontation. 2. Shifting blame to others. 3. Discouraging denial. 4. Use of information to provoke confession. 5. Reinforcing sincerity. 6. Suggesting alternatives. 7. Giving concrete alternatives. 8. Suspect repeats guilt in front of witnesses. And 9. Document confession. The technique led Colonel Russell Williams into a psychological state where he thought he had nowhere further to turn. Slowly, chinks in his denials revealed themselves, until eventually he broke. Colonel Williams confessed to the killing of Corporal Marie-France Camot, to the sexual assaults, to the peculiar break-ins, and crucially, to the murder of Jessica Lloyd. Stating his intention as wanting to protect his wife, he even pointed out on a map where exactly they would find Jessica's body.
Early the following morning, on February the 8th, 2010, police scrambled the location Colonel Williams had pointed out on the map. The intersection at Carey Road and East Hungerford Road was unpaved and dusty. It was surrounded by untamed greenery and was undeniably beautiful. But just 0.7 kilometres from that exact spot, officers discovered Jessica Lloyd's body. It brought a horrible end to the Lloyd's family's ordeal. There was, until that point, still a slim hope of finding her alive. Back in the brightly lit interrogation room, Colonel Williams had come to a realization. He had no place left to hide. His brash armor had disappeared and been replaced with a reluctant honesty. He looked shamefully at the floor, then back at Detective Smith as he recalled the horrific final moments of Jessica's life. Williams explained how he'd noticed Jessica Lloyd's home on his countless drives from his workplace, CFB Trenton, to his temporary cottage in Tweed. On one occasion, he'd seen her in the upstairs window, running on a treadmill. The following day, the house was vacant. That's when Williams first broke in a manner he had now done dozens of times elsewhere. Then, a day later, he returned in the knowledge that the house was no longer empty. Williams crept through Jessica's back patio door, calmly made his way to her bedroom and woke her up. His next actions were becoming awfully familiar. He beat Jessica Lloyd, moved her into his SUV, which was parked in an adjacent field, and drove back to his secluded cottage. There, Jessica's ordeal was just beginning. The next day, he raped, photographed, and beat her. Hours passed, hours devoid of any hope of survival. Then he led Jessica out to the car, under the pretense that she was safe and it was indeed finally over. But instead he beat her over the head, knocking her unconscious before strangling her to death. Williams moved Jessica's body into his garage. He then drove to Ottawa and spent the weekend with his wife.
There was an air of disbelief as news started to break about the identity of the intruder that had been tormenting the women of rural Ontario. Williams was a highly respected, publicly recognisable member of the military. It's no understatement to say he was the last person the locals, and indeed the police, expected to be the one responsible. Larry Jones, who was initially falsely accused of Williams' crimes, remembers exactly how police disregarded Colonel Williams as a suspect. when doing their initial door-to-door investigations into the spate of break-ins and sexual assaults in Tweed, officers knocked at Larry's door. He opened it, understanding exactly why they were there. The officer asked, "Do you know who lives next door?" There was no answer when we knocked. Larry told them, "That's my neighbour, Colonel Russell Williams, commanding officer at CFB Trenton." According to Jones, the officer replied quickly, "Well, I guess there's no sense looking at that guy then." Williams was the true-life depiction of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The very same day of his first murder, the murder of Mary France Comeau, Williams had made an appearance at a charity fundraiser. Ironically, during the event, he'd been in handcuffs. Unfortunately for the victims who came afterwards, it was part of a light-hearted demonstration. He even penned a letter to Mary France's family, one of condolence. And in the weeks afterwards, he appeared during the Olympic torch relay. He helped out with the relief mission following the earthquake in Haiti. He remained steadfast in his role as a commanding officer.
But Mr. Hyde was never far away. As the shock subsided, details made their way into the press. Canadians would come to learn about the shocking nature of Russell Williams' crimes. They'd learn that he took thousands of photographs, photos of himself masturbating while wearing women's underwear in their bedrooms. He videoed the murders and sexual assaults, and he kept a detailed log of his activities. In military fashion, Williams was able to detail each and every one of his movements and crimes to the second. So much so that he would even make an occasion of revisiting certain houses on the year anniversary of his initial intrusion. Williams soon found himself on suicide watch. In April 2010, at Quint Detention Centre in the rural town of Napanee, Williams attempted to take his own life. He was unsuccessful. On October 18, 2010, Williams appeared via video link in the Ontario Court of Justice, where he pleaded guilty to all charges. Two counts of first-degree murder, two counts of forcible confinement, two counts of sexual assault, and 82 charges relating to breaking and entering. 4 days later, Justice Robert F. Scott sentenced Williams to two concurrent terms of life imprisonment, with no consideration of parole for 25 years. It is unlikely that Russell Williams will ever be granted parole.
The colonel was naturally stripped of all military honours. He is no longer a colonel. Instead, he has the rest of his life to reflect on the pain and suffering he's caused. His victims number in the hundreds. Not just Marie-France Comeau and Jessica Lloyd, but the women he sexually assaulted, the women whose houses he broke into, piercing any ongoing sense of security. The families of all those who he murdered and abused became victims too. Then Larry Jones, who still to this day has to fight for his reputation after being wrongly accused of Williams' crimes. And lastly, those who knew and trusted him. The people who worked with him at CFB Trenton, the public, his family and friends, and his wife. But the list of victims could have been even longer still, were it not for the unusual tire marks on Williams' SUV. His crimes could have realistically continued for years.
Smoking Gun is a What's the Story original podcast series. It's narrated by me, Sarah Henderson.
And by me, Tracy Alexander. The series is supported by Forensic Response UK. Our work promotes the international fight to improve forensic techniques, to share ideas and develop the crime-solving scientific advances of the future.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please give it a rating and review. and help to spread the word. You can listen to a new episode of Smoking Gun every week wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to listen to all episodes right now, you can find them completely ad-free on our subscription channel, What's the Story Crime. On there, you'll also get exclusive access to a whole bunch of bonus interviews led by me, where I speak to some of the most experienced and skilled forensic scientists from around the world and find out more about what they do. Those interviews are only available on What's the Story Crime.
There's also a whole range of brilliant true crime content all made by the same team. You can check out The Missing, with more than 60 episodes all about long-term missing people, which invites you to try and help solve the case. You'll also find exclusive series like Jigsaw, true crime investigations like 900 Degrees, and incredible stories told over several parts. Whatever you're into, if you enjoy listening to Smoking Gun, we're sure you'll find your next must-listen podcast on What's the Story Crime. Signing up is really easy. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, just search for What's the Story Crime, subscribe, and you'll get all your favourite shows ad-free. For listeners on Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, or any other platform, all you need to do is click the link in our show notes or visit www.whatsthestorysounds.com/crime. Your subscription helps to ensure we can keep making more of the content you love. And it costs just $3.99 per month.